Tom Brown is a partner at Paul Hastings in the antitrust and competition and the global banking and payment systems practices. His work focuses on competition law and legal issues affecting the financial services industry. In addition to strategically advising payment systems and financial service clients across a broad spectrum of regulatory issues, he has litigated notable antitrust cases. Prior to private practice, he was vice president, senior counsel at Visa USA, Inc. And I have to say, from working with Tom and speaking with Tom about various payment issues over the years, he really can drill down into these issues in an almost scary fashion. And then Russell Schrader, Chief Privacy Officer and Senior Associate General Counsel for Global Enterprise Risk for Visa, Inc. And my wife told me to tell you that she has a Visa card. So I've done that now. He's responsible for privacy risk and payment system policies and legal issues at Visa and is a principal legal liaison for Visa financial institutions. He's on the advisory boards of the Future Privacy Forum and the Center for Information Policy Leadership's International Accountability Project. And then finally, Scott Shipman, Associate General Counsel at eBay. He started at eBay as an intern in 1998 when there were 70 employees and internet law was a new frontier. Scott says that we were making it up as we went along, and I am still making it up as I go along. So that's our terrific panel. And what we'll do now is I'll have a small, short presentation, and then Scott will get up here and show you two YouTube videos about what eBay's up to now in mobile payments. Okay. And can you hear me in the back? I'll try to be a little louder. Okay. So just very briefly, what I'd like to do is set up this topic. It's just to make a couple of quick points. So first of all, mobile payments. One thing that really leaps out when we talk about mobile payments and it's something that we will elaborate in our discussion to come is that there really are many different approaches, many different models in this space. We'll touch on them in the discussion to come, and of course they raise very different legal issues, and I'm not attempting here to do any kind of systematic taxonomy, but there are mobile payment approaches that go through apps and different kinds of mobile wallet models. It's possible, of course, as one of these illustrations shows, to work through a credit card company, Hi-Russ. And then with PayPal, different kinds of approaches. We'll hear more from that from Scott. And so what we have here is a PayPal device that attaches to the smartphone's audio port and a different way of paying. And then as one of the illustrations shows, you can do this through near-field communication as well. And so as Bloomberg Business has said, easy mobile payments are almost here. And, of course, the key part of the headline is the almost part. And so that's going to be part of the trick, part of the task here, is to make the almost go away from that headline. And I think that another key aspect is going to be assuaging consumer concern about privacy and security. Nonetheless, mobile payments, although they're almost here, actually are a huge financial factor. And so here we have an illustration, and I wonder what this man is holding. Let's see. He's holding a big bag of money, a big, big bag. And so already the mobile payments market, according to Forrester Research, was almost $13 billion in 2012. According to this analysis, it's going to increase by $90 billion by 2017. And there are other methodologies, there's other ways of estimating this market. It's clear, however, that it's going to be a very significant growth field. And here's a very interesting report from three of my colleagues at Berkeley, Chris Hufnagel, Jennifer Urban, and Sue Lee. And one of the aspects of this paper was they made a controversial policy proposal to extend Song Beverly-like protections to mobile payments. And so what they want to do is extend statutory protection, so you have to have a kind of opt-in to sharing of personal information with merchants and others with whom data are shared. Other aspects of their report were certainly less controversial. So first of all, interestingly enough, they at the very start of the report said mobile payments technology actually offer potential to increase data security far above what we have now with more traditional credit cards in this country. They also say that, and this is where their Song Beverly proposal comes in, that more information is going to be shared within the payments infrastructure with more participants than ever before. And so the result is going to be more detailed dossiers about consumer behavior. And government policymakers have already begun to look at this area. And so we have a very interesting FTC staff report from March 2013. They first held a valuable workshop on the topic. It led to this staff report. And so some of the points of this, and we have Laura Berger who will talk to these as well, is to consider privacy by design, so to build in privacy and security into mobile payments. Also, to provide greater transparency about data practices in the mobile payments context, and I think Laura wants to speak to that in particular. And of course, that's very challenging because there is so little available real estate in mobile devices. And then need to increase data security. There's also some binding law in this area, but before we get to that, on the way to that, the big point is that there's not going to be a lot of privacy in the financial payment space vis-a-vis the government. And indeed, and so on that point, we've got ex-NSA official Stuart Inglis telling tech companies, be transparent. Of course, we've got to, this is great advice, and I have to note the irony here, that the NSA person is telling Silicon Valley, you have to share more information about what you're doing. And of course, while we're having our irony alert today, I've got to share, I didn't put a slide up about this, but it was too great. So within the last 48 hours, our senator in California, Dianne Feinstein, as you may have been following, is absolutely outraged that the CIA has been spying on her Senate Intelligence Committee. And so now all I kept thinking was, now she's upset. And also, you know, the French poet Arthur Rimbaud could see words as colors. And I don't have that ability, but I have a soundtrack of rock and roll that accompanies me through life. I don't know what that psychological phenomenon is. So when I was seeing that headline with Senator Feinstein, the song I kept hearing was Bob Dylan, Like a Rolling Stone, where he sings, how does it feel? So that would be the on the soundtrack to that particular episode. Okay, so as I've told you, we don't really have privacy vis-a-vis the government, and what in a way that companies can really very effectively negotiate around. And so what I'm trying to just the basic point here is the framework is really very much set. And it's been set for a long time about how government gets information about financial transactions. These are laws like the Bank Secrecy Act, which dates back to 1970. We have the agency that's responsible for this and various regulations, including the Know Your Customer rule. We've got the FinCEN Enforcement Network. And so really the key idea here is that customers of mobile payment will have limited choices. They may have choices about other aspects of privacy, but not really towards how the government is going to be getting this information. And so here's a recent op-ed by Julia Angwin in the New York Times, and her point is that privacy may be becoming a luxury good where you can get more if you're willing to pay for certain kinds of products and services. But really, when it comes to financial information, leaving Bitcoin and kind of the special issues regarding that to the side, there's really not going to be a lot of add-ons, because at the end of the day, we have the Bank Secrecy Act, we have FinCEN, and information is going to flow into the government for various policy reasons. Okay. So next up, I do just want to say a quick word about the Song-Beverly Credit Card Act, 1971. It's been amended subsequently because this is a California statute and we're in California. So it restricts businesses from requesting that cardholders provide personal identification information during credit card transactions and then recording that information. And there's been lots of interesting, important case law in this area, some of which Tom Brown has been involved in as a litigator. And so there are open questions, however, about the extent to which the Song-Beverly Credit Card Act applies to mobile payments. And so as an example, what about GPS information and tying that to information that shows that the person asking for the credit is actually in the store in person in question, which would be potentially a great verification that the credit should be authorized. There's also important security issues here as well. And this is, of course, something that the public really cares about and is scared about. And so here, of course, the headline is the Target data breach, which impacted significantly on their profit. So the article shows Target profits fell more than 40% in the fourth quarter. So here, and this is going to be my last slide, and then we'll go to Scott. What are the security issues for smartphones? And here, let me just put up a couple. Note, however, as Chris Hufnagel and his co-authors argue in their paper, we have great potential here. We have great promise here. We can get better security through mobile payments if done right. So one issue, the smartphone is a small device, and so it's vulnerable to threat to theft and loss. Second issue, smartphone is very likely to have sensitive information on it, apart from financial payments. We carry our contacts on it. We carry family photographs. We have all kinds of other records. They may be sensitive to malware in different ways and in new kind of ways. There may be vulnerabilities in the OS. There may be vulnerabilities in apps. I talked about how there's a very diffuse market for mobile payments, including all kinds of companies that want to offer digital wallets. And so whereas you know your bank and you have a track record with them, there may be all kinds of other new parties getting into this area. There may be weaknesses in wireless security that impact in this area, and of course other issues which we will hear from the panel. So let me conclude now, and we'll go to Scott, and then we'll turn to the panel and Laura.
Good morning. All right, before I pull up these two short videos, I thought there's so much technology that we're talking about that is coming. It's actually here, but you may not have it yet. Some of you may, but it's coming. And so it's hard to picture technology unless you actually have a picture. So that's a bit of the context for the videos. The second piece of concepts that I think are important is, as this is new, people would say, oh, well, it'd be likely that there'll be mistakes, that you'll have to iterate and change. And of course, those statements would be absolutely true. So there's a lot of testing that is going on. I think what is fascinating, particularly around the security component, is the Target point of sale system had malware. So malware is not a new concept. That was the challenge. That's what happened with Target. Your device, your mobile phone, can be designed in a way to have those vulnerabilities, or it could be designed in a way such that none of your sensitive financial information is actually on the phone. So malware or no malware, it could be a secure device or an insecure device. So a lot of these concepts and a lot of the work that my team does at eBay and PayPal is to make sure that while we do test and learn in many aspects of the technology, we don't want to test and learn on security, and we don't want to test and learn on customers' gut reaction to how something feels, right? Are you sharing or selling my information to third parties, or can I trust that you're not without my explicit consent? When I walk by a store and they send me or surface, they accept PayPal, did you give them all of my information, or don't they know about me yet? It's all anonymous until I decide to check in, right? So the defaults that we've initiated, not based on law, not based on regulation, but based on our ability to test and learn and try to preserve the right reaction for the customer, is it's opt-in for geolocation. It's Bluetooth must be turned on. Wi-Fi must be turned on. If you want to have an ongoing, automatically checked-in experience with a store, you have to say, I want to have an automatically checked-in experience with this store, not the other way around. If you check in with one Jamba Juice, it doesn't mean you're checked in to every Jamba Juice, and so on and so forth. Now, we may, over time, as we learn, change those preferences based on what you as consumers tell us. And so I would expect those experiences to change as the services and offerings change. So I'm going to share with you two. They're approximately 1 minute video each. They're on YouTube. There are many videos on YouTube about PayPal and the payments technologies that are coming. Some of them are actually quite funny. If you were to type in PayPal and zombie apocalypse, I highly recommend that video. I still get a laugh out of it. It's about 4 minutes long, and I felt that would be too long for this presentation today. So without further ado, I will... This first video is about currently a Bluetooth technology called Beacon. And man, I really didn't want the company to call it that, but they chose what they chose. This is Bluetooth technology in storefront that would enable you to pay. And if you were checked in with the store, you could keep your phone in your pant pocket, walk in, grab the merchandise, wave, and walk out. The marketing slogan that I think this campaign should have is keep it in your pants. And I don't know why the marketing team thinks that that's odd that the lawyer is recommending that. But I suspect even on college campuses, parents would be happy with that slogan.
Sometimes you feel like you're running all day long. And sometimes it's nice to have some help with the little things along the way. The PayPal app, with hands-free checking to pay, is designed to help manage the little things so they don't get in your way. It lets you set your preferences so you can automatically check in and pay with PayPal on your mobile device at businesses that you choose. No wallet or cash required. Because the little things can add up when you're on the go. The PayPal seamlessly connects with PayPal Beacon, a state-of-the-art, low-energy Bluetooth device in your favorite stores that helps you get what you want when you want. The PayPal and PayPal Beacon making hands-free payments reality. Here's to the little things.
All right, so some of the technologies you saw there, skip the line. Check in with a store, skip the line. That means a software update on the point of sale within the store had to occur. When you check in, literal face recognition, your picture of your face, shows up on the point of sale along with your name. The merchant can look down, see that you're in the store, there's your face, you've checked in, you've scanned these three items, you wave, and out you go. Right? Skip the line. Also in the boutique, you can do similar type of payments in that sense. You can order ahead. We saw that with the cafe. So she was on the run, needed a coffee, checked into the cafe, picked the items she wanted, and they bring them right out to her on the fly, those types of things. The same type of technology or services could be available via Wi-Fi. And, of course, depending on how you configure Wi-Fi or how you configure Bluetooth, you could have virtually no privacy or you could have all the privacy you need. The second video is a recent announcement of the Samsung implementation with the third, in essence, layer of authentication, which is the algorithm derived from your finger and then enabling you from that phone or now watch to be able to do many of the same functionalities. So to me, the relevant piece here is when we're talking about mobile payments, you know, I mentioned earlier that you could just keep the phone in your pants. The watch on your wrist, you know, does it become a little device in your ear? Soon, you know, the glasses, right? Mobile payment is not just the phone. And I think this video, while not purposefully illustrating that, does demonstrate that point.
Here's a quick PayPal check-in. Barcelona, Spain, site of Mobile World Congress, a huge industry show where all the players make announcements, and PayPal makes a couple big ones with Samsung. First, fingerprint authentication on the new Samsung Galaxy S5 smartphone. So to buy something with PayPal on mobile or in-store, just swipe a finger and you're in. No logins or passwords necessary. It's faster and more secure, and it rolls out to Galaxy S5 owners in 26 markets this April. Second, PayPal is the first payment provider on the Samsung Gear 2 smartwatch. The app lets you check in and pay in the local store, save and redeem offers, and get payment notifications. Watch, free, timely, roll out in April. Tell me how you get the information. Second hand. Okay, so for the latest, be sure to follow PayPal in all the right places. That's your PayPal check-in. I'm Mark Kronak. Check it out.
And with that, you're all now technology payments experts.
We'll hear from Laura and then Russ and then Tom.
Terrific. Good morning, everyone. It's wonderful to be here. Of course, I'm an attorney for the Federal Trade Commission, but I'll be speaking as a staff attorney and not on behalf of the commission or any commissioner. Obviously, you know, from our discussion so far today, and every time I hear people talking about mobile payments, it's exciting to think about the great benefits that can accrue to consumers, but as an attorney focused on law enforcement, I also have to think critically about a number of the problems. So please keep in mind, I think all of this technology is fantastic, but I'm just going to run through quickly some of the problems that and potential pitfalls that that I think, from my experience, folks should keep in mind. So first, based on this morning's discussion, obviously there is, as Paul mentioned, the potential and Hufnagel and Urban mentioned the potential for better data security with these mobile payment solutions. But, you know, our agency's brought over 50 data security cases, and those also illustrate there are potential pitfalls with any technology. And I can see some possibilities here. Our recent cases against HTC and TrendNet show that we have come to evaluate the integrity and appropriateness of software testing as part of a company's reasonableness for its data security practices, whether that's under the FTC Act, unfairness or deception, or under, could be under another standard like the FCRA or the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act. So that's something to think about. And depending upon how a mobile payment technology is set up, I could see the potential for it to break some of the expertise that, and you know, perhaps we can hear about this, but that credit card companies have developed for identifying ongoing fraud and a common point of purchase. If all a credit card company is now going to know is which payment solution the consumer used, it may be, I don't know, we'll have to discuss that, but it may be harder than for credit card companies to deploy the expertise they have to recognize ongoing fraud. So these are all, and if the security of the mobile payment system relies upon the user's device security, and the fact that the user is who they say they are and that they don't have malware on their individual user device, you can introduce a lot of vulnerabilities to the system that way. So these are all things to keep in mind for just the data security piece of it. And since I'm being a downer on the panel, let me just run through a few other concerns that may exist. So obviously under the FTC Act, there can be deception issues. You know, we've had 3 mobile cramming cases and 2 dozen or more desktop cramming cases. You want to make sure that you adequately and fully disclose what the charges are going to be put on, for example, if you're doing a carrier billing model. And I think our revised .com disclosures do a great job, have lots of screenshots and examples illustrating the importance of disclosures and how to make them on a mobile device just under our basic FTC Act deception analysis. You have to also consider the Fair Credit Reporting Act. If you are indeed extending credit, which you may be if you are deferring payment on, you know, through a carrier billing or other model for mobile payments, you have to consider whether you are taking the steps required by the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And you also may want to consider the risk-based pricing rule that we recently enforced against Time Warner. I've mentioned safeguards already, but some of you who already operate in the financial products and services sphere may be aware of the Gramm-Leach-Bliley privacy and safeguards rule that will apply if you're significantly engaged in financial services like data processing for financial or payment information. And the last point I'm going to make, I think this is really interesting to think about, and this came my awareness of this came from reading Hufnagel and Urban's report. The consumers have protections from certain types of marketing under, for example, the telemarketing sales rule. And I think that report did a great job illustrating how consumers may suddenly have existing business relationships through actions they take on their mobile phones that they're not aware that they have. And they may be surprised to start receiving certain telemarketing contacts. So you want to be careful, you know, not to cross the line, not to do something that requires express written consent, like robocalling or automated phone calling. But you also, I guess, want to, from a policy standpoint, think about what your consumers may be expecting. And just to bring it full circle, as the FTC requires you to, for, you know, material terms and conditions, you want to make sure that you have adequately disclosed those. So I'm gonna pitch it back to the panel with that, and we can mention more principles from our broader reports as we go along.
Excellent. Rusty? Thanks. First, kudos to the FTC for all the work that you've done. You guys have been really, really good about holding workshops, meeting with everybody, getting to understand the issues, realizing that there is this broad framework already out there, both, you know, not just in Section 5, the unfair and deceptive, not just in Gramm-Leach-Bliley, the FCC, a whole panoply of things that are out there to protect consumers. And what we're trying to do now is to figure out how are those, you know, harms-based protections that are all over the place, how do they apply into the mobile world? And one of the interesting things when you work at a place like Visa, how many new people are being pulled in at different types of things. When you talk about mobiles, you know, we also, you know, you start at the beginning with what are the devices and the platforms. And, the video talked about Samsung. Visa's been working with Samsung. You work with a lot of different device makers to figure out what is that device, what is the OS, how do payments work in, what are the built-in security features, what are the built-in privacy protections. And they differ based on the kind of device and platform you use. And a second kind of new type of people coming in are the mobile operators. And you look at ISIS and some of the payments things that they've been trying to get into. And, you know, as more people say, I want to do payments, you sit there and say, payments is hard. You know, it really is. For example, your mobile phone provider wants to do payments. That's terrific. What's their customer service look like? When you call up your credit card company, your debit card company, say, that's not my charge, it's usually a different response when you call Verizon, for example, not to pick on them, say, that's not my charge. It really, so the back end piece that kind of payments providers and that mobile operators are going to have to build in for those kind of protections is also something to look at. Beyond that, you have what is going to be the payment platform, what is actually going to be the way that, you know, you pay. PayPal is a perfect payment platform, as is a Visa. You know, Amazon is a payment platform where you can, you know, Jeff Bezos will sell you anything, and deliver it in all kinds of different ways to your house by drone or whatever. So you have to look at those payment platforms. And finally, you have to look at the commerce market and the players within the commerce market. And here, you know, eBay, you know, you have the market there. What are their securities? What's their protections? Google, you know, Google Shopping, what is their privacy? What is their security? What is their things? So it's a very, very more complicated market than the I walk into a store and I pay with a fob, my beacon, my card, a PIN, my picture. So there's more players here that you need to look at and need to figure out what are they doing and are they doing the right thing? Are they doing a harmonized thing to keep information safe and also to disclose what they're doing in terms of privacy? Even if you get all that right, you then start to look at what is a frictionless commerce? What does the consumer want? You know, we're all familiar with, you know, the Apple, a consumer doesn't know what they want until we show them kind of Steve Jobs thing. And that's true. You know, the NFC versus a QR code, whether it's some other kind of code, whether it's interacting in the cloud. And when you get into the cloud, okay, where does jurisdiction, what does the cloud mean to people? You know, it just is very, very hard to explain, to put your finger on, and to make sure that consumers understand what they are consenting to, what the risks and what the protections are that they have above and beyond. And then security. Paul, you pointed out about Target. Target had some very sophisticated security procedures. They didn't have every sophisticated security procedure, and no one really can. It's a moving target. Criminals are constantly looking for the easiest path. They are looking for ways to break into things. Even you look at the recession, one of the things we found is that criminal gangs have not really had their infrastructure budgets and their IT budgets cut. You know, when you're in one of these mobs, you know, if there's a layoff, it's either law enforcement or cement overshoes in the Volga. So, you know, they really don't have the kind of, you know, reductions in staff and reductions in budgets that others have had. And so you really are trying to work together and figure out how to deal with security. I think one of the things is, you know, even if you can break in past all the layers of defenses, I think we've all gotten away from the firewall, fortress wall kind of thinking. You just have to realize as they get through all those defenses, there's nothing inside, right? The gold has left Fort Knox. The data is not usable. It's not there. And so that's why Visa is looking very closely at things like tokenization, so that you have a string of code that is not usable by anybody except the person who put it there for the transaction that was there. And those are kinds of leaps in thinking that we're trying to bring throughout the entire ecosystem in payments as we deal with all of these new stakeholders. So it's a very complicated, it's a very exciting thing. I bristled a little bit. The only thing she said I bristled at was she said credit card company. Not credit. Debit. Mobile. Yeah. Prepaid. Yeah. Not cards. Yeah. Phones. Mm-hmm. Faces. Fobs. So, Fair enough. it's very much a high-tech thing at this point, and it's very much a payments company. Otherwise, I'm totally behind you.
Thanks, Russ. It's always nice to follow my former boss, but not my current employer, and not someone for whom I am currently working. So it's nice to feel like a bit of a free agent in the conversation about information security and privacy. Although I am a partner at Paul Hastings, am not here speaking on behalf of Paul Hastings, any of the firm's clients, any of my own clients, or my other sometimes employer, UC Berkeley Law School. I always find it interesting to talk about privacy, and some of you here have actually taken my class on mobile payments at UC Berkeley, and so you'll have heard this before, or have heard me speak on the subject generally. I find it interesting to talk about the subject of privacy because I have a very, very difficult time understanding what it means. I think it's an elusive concept. I think we often think about privacy as concealing, right? So the idea is that we're shrouding something about ourselves. And then the question is, I think there are several questions, maybe. So what are we concealing? From whom are we concealing it? And to what end are we concealing it? And I do promise that I'll connect all of this back to mobile payments in a second. So in the area of payments, movement of money, whether you're funding it with an open line of credit on a credit card or whether you're linked to your bank account or some other value store, what is it that we think we're concealing and from whom? If I walk into a merchant and engage in a transaction, as I did yesterday, in buying a sandwich over a lunch counter, am I concealing my name? Am I concealing the amount of the payment? Am I concealing the subject of the order? Am I trying to do that from the merchant? If so, that's going to create kind of an unsatisfying lunch experience, because then at the end, when they actually produce the sandwich, they won't know to whom to deliver it, or they might deliver the wrong sandwich to the wrong person. And that wouldn't be any fun, since at the moment I'm not eating red meat or trying to avoid it except if it's really good, like it was at last night's dinner. Thank you, Paul. Because then I'll get the red meat and then somebody else will get the chicken with hard-boiled egg, which maybe they don't like. You know, maybe they're OVO intolerant. So I think we have to ask, any OVO intolerance in the audience? No? Okay. Well, that's good.
They're being private about it.
but this becomes interesting, right? So, like, if I've revealed my OVO intolerance in front of everybody, and I can do so credibly, now we can formulate a guess as to the rest of your OVO intolerance, right? Something no doubt that will be discussed later on today. But this concept of what am I concealing, right? So I have a Visa card, courtesy of Chase. This is a tokenized means of value exchange. That is, in order for it to work, I have to provide either the physical token or the information that is written on the front or magnetically inscribed on the mag stripe at the back in order to function. Do we have in mind that information is something that's going to be concealed? And again, from whom and to what end, right? So these things seem to me to be not terribly well understood, not necessarily by consumers, who I think are quite well accustomed to an ordinary commercial experience in which they're providing their name, the amount of the payment, and either a token that accomplishes the payment or some information about themselves that will enable the person who's providing the good or service to collect payment in connection with that transaction. So if we're not protecting it from the recipient of the value exchange, who do we think we're shielding it from? So before Paul mentioned it, I want a show of hands, how many people in the room had heard of the Bank Secrecy Act? Okay, great. I want you to keep your hand in the air. Hold on. Keep your hands in the air. How many think that the Bank Secrecy Act protects your secrets from the government? Really? Really? You thought that? Like, honest and truly? That's frightening. Because the Bank Secrecy Act is probably, I mean, there are a lot of misnamed government statutes, but this is one that definitely fails the FTC's deception test. The Bank Secrecy Act requires the federal government, I mean, requires banks to spy on their customers and to report all of the information about their transactions to the federal government. So it's not like we can call it the Bank Secrecy Act, but it's really the Bank Spying Act. Anybody remember the clipper chip debates in the 1990s? Right. So this concern that we had about embedding technologies into our communication devices that would enable people to monitor constantly our communications, right? That was really scary. Well, so that's what the Bank Secrecy Act does for financial services. It requires banks to report everything that they detect as suspicious to the Treasury Department in connection with those transactions. So if we're not protecting the information from disclosure to the merchant, who's sort of a necessary counterparty to any commercial transaction, and we're required by law to share all of the information associated with transactions with the government, who are we not sharing information with? What are we trying to conceal? And to what end? And so the third, like, so we've talked about the merchant. We've talked about the government. Now, I think we can maybe mostly rule those out. Now, so who's the third person that we're maybe, or third group of people that we're trying to shield information from? Both Russ and Laura mentioned obliquely fraudsters, the people who are then thrown into the Volga with the cement shoes when they're not good at their jobs, right? So I think we can all agree that we don't want our information to get in the hands of people who would use it to do us harm, right? To engage, for example, in transactions that we haven't authorized. I presumably don't need to have another show of hands, like, for everybody who would agree with that general concept, right? So, but do I need to prevent the sharing of information with those folks in order to protect people against the prospect of harm? Like, that's one thing that you can do, right? You can shield or conceal the information in such a way that it prevents people from using it to that end. Or we can take the approach that we've taken in the U.S. since the 1970s through the Truth in Lending Act and the Electronic Funds Transfer Act, which is to protect consumers against the consequence of the misuse of the information. So if your payment card, whether it's a credit card or a debit card, is used without your authorization, you have rights under Reg E or Reg Z to shift that liability back to the bank that issued you the card. There are other ways of getting to the same end that we might seek to achieve by creating rules against the sharing of information. Like, we don't really need a rule or law that says don't share information with fraudsters, right? There are other ways of distributing the costs and consequences of the misuse of the information than thinking about it in privacy terms. Mm-hmm. How does all of this connect back to mobile payments? It connects back to mobile payments because one other theory of regulation, right, so aside from seeking to protect consumers, right, is that regulation is often hijacked by those generally incumbents who are seeking to protect themselves against encroachment by innovators. So today, for example, a government not known for its tendencies to promote competition announced a crackdown on internet commerce. I am, of course, speaking of the PRC, which has been lobbied by Chinese banks to crack down on internet banks sponsored by Alibaba and others. Alibaba, over the course of the last 18 to 24 months, has grown into the single largest non-chartered financial institution in China. And today, the PRC told them that they had to stop issuing virtual credit cards because of security concerns. I think that the motivation in China to prevent Alibaba from issuing virtual credit cards has very little to do with security concerns and very much to do with protecting Chinese banks from the flight of capital to out of their banks and into Alibaba. And when we hear, and I don't mean to be too cynical about this, but when we hear about U.S. banks and entrenched U.S. Companies in the money movement business worrying audibly about security, what we should be really worrying, what we should maybe be thinking about just a little bit, is efforts on their part to protect the place that they have in the realm of money movement from encroachment on the part of incumbents. Because when we shift from a plastic form of payment to a mobile device or to something that's associated in a unique way with my person, not totally clear what a network that connects banks to merchants offers in a more ubiquitously networked world. So with that, I'll turn it over to Paul.
Excellent. So I have, I think I'm going to ask two questions to the panel and ask them simultaneously, and that way you can answer the one that you wish to answer. And by the way, I forgot to introduce myself. So I'm Paul Schwartz, and I'm a professor at UC Berkeley and also director of the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology.
And
I am a special advisor in the privacy and data security practice with Paul Hastings with Tom Brown. So that's how I know that he knows so much about payment law. Okay. So the two questions are, I want to ask a question about synthetic ID fraud, and I want to ask a question about the kind of Hufnagel and co-authors question about issue about Info Merchants. So on synthetic, and I'll get them both out. On the synthetic ID fraud, something that Russ and I have talked a little bit about on the phone, the argument is Tom's mentioned Regulation E and Regulation Z, and the point is then that you're covered, right? Even though if in the regulations it's $50 worth of liability maximum on your credit card, most credit card companies then waive that, and so the theory would be zero liability, so everything's wonderful in the world. Don't worry, be happy. There's been another argument, though, that's made that the real danger is synthetic ID fraud, that elements of what's stolen, for example, at Target, will be combined with other data elements. New identities, blended identities, will be created, and so it'll be even more difficult for the target of the credit card fraud to know about it because it's somebody else, and then the danger is at the end of the day, the person whose credit was breached at Target or somewhere else will not know about that it happened at Target or somewhere else and yet be stuck with the liability at the end from all kinds of things that happen through synthetic ID fraud. So let me pose that, and you may or may not want to answer that. And then the other thing to get a discussion going would be Tom spoken about the whole issue of information to the government, not a lot of choice there, and so the Hufnagel et al. Study kind of drills down to something else and looks at kind of the ecosystem of information as it gets shared traditionally, and the ecosystem, how information will be shared if we move to mobile payments. And so what they argue then is the new payment systems will make it easier for merchants to build customer databases without resorting to loyalty cards. So on the merchant side, they'll be the relative winners, and then they go on to say this shift has profound consequences for consumer privacy and the relationship consumers have with payment providers and merchants. The need for loyalty cards will be eliminated, but so too could the ability of individuals to avoid profiling, and hence their recommendation for Song Beverly-like protection. So their thought is, if when you use your traditional credit card in a store in California, the merchant can ask you generally for additional identifying information, and Tom's litigating these things, so you'll have something to say in a second. And I got an eye roll, so I feel kind of happy I got a Tom Brown eye roll. But just to quickly finish, and so the notion then is, why should Song Beverly be altered so radically? Because now we have a mobile payment, and then the consumer walks in, and then the merchant has all this rich information because now they can kind of trace purchases and do all kinds of other things. Okay, so let me stop here. I guess, Tom, through your eye roll, you get to go first, okay. And we'll go to Laura. Yeah. I can see you want to say something. We'll go to Scott and then Russ.
I was just going to caution anybody who's actually in the retail business and who accepts a card from requesting or requiring the consumer to provide you additional information. That may have the consequence of creating significant amounts of liability for the merchant, e.g., the Williams-Sonoma case. So, you know, there's a significant grain of salt that needs to be taken with what Paul said. There's more permission in the online space thanks to a case, Crescent versus Apple, but requiring consumers or requesting of consumers in California to present other information at the point of sale is a danger on the order of sending out unsolicited text messages under the TCPA. That was a joke for you, Scott. TCPA jokes generally go a lot further in privacy crowds than this.
They're laughing on the inside.
They like more audible laughter. So this idea of synthetic ID fraud is a really interesting one. It's interesting, I think, on a couple of different levels, right? So the idea, just for those of you're trying to keep track is that, that information will be obtained through a data security breach of the sort that was at Target. People will use it in combining it with other information to create either non-existent IDs or to create personas around other people's actual IDs, so other people's social security numbers, and then using that ID obtain credit or some other service for which they don't pay. Okay, that sort of synthetic ID theft. The primary victim of that, the primary victim, not the only victim, but the primary victim of that is the service provider, frequently a bank, that extends credit or provides service to the fraudster who has created this synthetic identity, right? Because the fraudster is not going to pay the bank back when it obtains a loan or if it goes to a car dealer and drives a car off of a lot, right? The person that provides that good or service or extends credit in connection with that ID is the person that's out of pocket. Now, there are definitely consequences to the person whose social security number has been associated with that ID when it shows up on their credit report, right? And that's an issue. And how one allocates the cost of those problems is something that has existed in the ID space for quite a long time. But it actually relates to something that Laura mentioned earlier, which is the Fair Credit Reporting Act. Because I think, and this is a question, I think that the Fair Credit Reporting Act and the protections that are associated with the Fair Credit Reporting Act are actually premised on the idea that the person who's seeking to obtain credit can be definitively identified, and that we're then making a projection or estimate as to the extent to which that person has the capacity to repay the loan. What we don't generally think of the Fair Credit Reporting Act applying to is efforts to assemble information to determine whether somebody is who they purport to be. One of the challenges that exists in, for example, a report that was just issued by the NCLC, the National Consumer Law Center, around big data and its application to credit is this confusion between, on the one hand, collecting information to make sure that, you know, this guy who says he's Tom Brown is actually the crazy Tom Brown who shows up and says he doesn't know what privacy is versus the Tom Brown who, like, is a labor lawyer in Southern California and maybe his dad, right? Like, that the distinguishing between these two people actually requires information and is a non-trivial problem and may indeed then correlate with credit losses, right? Because if somebody obtains a loan and doesn't make a first payment, right, we can call that fraud or we can call it a credit loss. And I don't think I don't think we have really good norms or law in thinking about how the FCRA applies in the authentication space versus the making an estimate of the actual Tom Brown's capacity to repay.
So let me quickly respond about the question that that Paul raised about the increase in the amount of information that retailers and others can get through the ecosystem, and then move to this interesting FCRA point that Tom has made. And I also have to respond about that sandwich order at some point. But I think what the Hoofnagel and Urban report said about how retailers and those implementing mobile payment type solutions, whether they're coupons to the mobile phone or mobile payment solutions, that's one of the key concerns identified in our mobile payments report as well, that because of the number of players with access to mobile phone data and because of the tools they may implement, data that previously was segmented among various players may be pooled together in ways consumers don't expect. And I think that's one of the key privacy concerns that's talked about in this area. So moving on to the synthetic ID, I would say this is old wine, new bottle, because always in one of our key areas, we are tasked by Congress to maintain an identity theft database where consumers can report identity theft and its harm, and we do outreach to consumers, providing them with tools to help them make police reports and to address the harms of identity theft. I do have to note my strong disagreement with Tom about who the key victim is when a consumer's identity is stolen. I would not think it would necessarily be the bank, but would be the consumer, because your credit report is going to reflect things that people are doing in your name, and if it's a fraudster, that's going to cause you big, big problems. But the reason that I say this is old wine, new bottle, is because I think there's always been an issue. You know, you can have an account compromised, and the salient distinction in the mobile payments area is that your dispute resolution procedures for your mobile payment account may not necessarily match those of your traditional credit tools, whether they be a card or otherwise. When an identity thief or fraudster takes the further step to compromise your account, that's just another way of getting to this longstanding, persistent, and very serious issue of identity theft for consumers. Mm-hmm. The FCRA point that Tom raised is really, really interesting. So when is identity verification going to be consumer report information? And those of you who work in the area of FCRA know it's not a simple question to answer. The phone book is not going to be probably a consumer report. So if you're a general, to be a consumer report, you have to meet three. It has to be consumer report information, which is not necessarily a hard element to satisfy. If it's bearing on eligibility, so if verifying your identity is what's going to determine your eligibility, you may meet that prong. But it also has to be, and this is where the phone book can breathe a sigh of relief, it also has to be from a consumer reporting agency, which is an entity that assembles or evaluates consumer report information for the purpose of furnishing it to parties for eligibility. So if you're a general verification service and you don't exist for the purpose of helping companies establish eligibility for credit, you're not as likely to be a CRA. So this is a difficult area, and I agree there's some...
Like, how does that work for Twitter, right? So I can sign into a service for Twitter, and I'm not eligible to use the service unless I can authenticate my Twitter account for them? Does that
so
term
eligibility
Twitter...
is a term of art in the CRA. So it has to be eligibility for things that are covered by the Credit Reporting Act, like insurance, employment, or credit. So it's not just your eligibility to send out a tweet or something else.
But to send money and to have it settled later.
Yeah. So, I mean, there may always be questions of fact about whether the activity in question is indeed the extension of credit or insurance. It's a difficult – it is a factual question, so that's true. And then it has to, in fact, be used to make eligibility determinations, which in Tom's hypothetical, it was. It was the main factor used to decide if a consumer was eligible to receive credit. So, I mean, I can see lots of good arguments why you would want the FCRA protections to apply. If a consumer is going to be denied whatever instrument of credit it is in the mobile payment context because they can't establish they are who they say they are, that consumer has a problem, and they need the remedies of the FCRA to have access to that report to know if there's something that they need to correct.
But I should tell the fraudster that you're not eligible because I can't confirm you are who you purport to be, even though you're claiming to be somebody that you're not?
Right. So there can be a communication problem, but the actual consumer, if there's a mix-up about your identity, sure, maybe you won't find out. Maybe only the fraudster will find out. But if you don't give a report to any consumer, there is no chance the right consumer will find out.
And that's one of the interesting things. I mean, yes, Reg E and Reg Z are very important protections, and Visa and others have gone further than those with zero liability. And even the CFPB, when they put out their consumer bulletin a couple weeks ago after the Target breach, their analysis did move a lot on fair credit billing. They were talking about, you know, whether it was an authorized transaction, and they actually drew some interesting lines for the CFPB where we hadn't seen it before, as to whether the number was hacked or stolen versus, you know, something that was given out and breached. But once again, even if you're talking about the CFPB and you're talking about Reg E and Reg Z, you're talking about allocating the loss. What we're trying to talk about is preventing the loss in the first place, doing that kind of authentication, doing those kinds of walls, doing that kind of layered security, doing that kind of tokenization that keeps the identity safe so that you don't have all of these problems spinning out in different controls. And you get to the FCRA, I suppose the one big benefit to consumers at a whole that it would target is that who hasn't shopped at the Target? I won't make you raise your hands. It may be embarrassing. But, you know, there's that everybody gets free credit monitoring who signs up for it. You know, the bad actors in the market have made more available what the FTC and others made available with the one free credit report a year. And so I think there is now more availability of that kind of information that gives you a better shot in the highly unlikely event that synthetic identity theft occurs. I'm sorry, I jumped in ahead of you.
That's fine. Good points. A couple of themes are emerging here. Specifically first to address the question around the Hufnagel study. If I think of Tom's comments, and we were talking about who are we concerned about having the information, and the government has access to the information, the merchant knows who I am at a very small level to get me my sandwich. I didn't get to hear your comment on his comment about
I'm
the sandwich.
I'm reserving a moment to respond to the sandwich scenario at the end if there is
and And what I find fascinating is that while the government has had broad access and continues to have broad access to this information, what we've seen with the digital revolution is that merchants historically have been left in the dark. If it's a credit card payment, whether it's Song Beverly or whether it's the you know PCI standards or whatever it may be, the merchant no longer, for a long time, has the ability to really provide you with the service that you may have had historically. I tell the quick story of going to the men's shop with my dad as a boy, and the men's shop greeting me by name, knowing the color lollipop that I liked, knowing my dad's jacket size and my size, and that it was April or May, so we were probably doing an Easter Sunday suit or shirt for myself and for him. And that's all very specific knowledge about my family and myself and my sister and my mom. And today we make it almost impossible for a merchant to provide that level of service today, right? Now, it's not to say that we should make it default on so that every merchant could provide you that service, but in most cases it's very difficult for a merchant to even obtain or get that information, to even begin to blow away your expectations. And how many of us love it if we are the premier global traveler and we get this amazing service at the lounges in the airports as we move through the world? Or how many of us love it when we do walk into a store and they've remembered our name and they have five things set aside so that our shopping experience is faster? Or that they, of course, know that my drink is a non-fat mocha, and I like an extra shot. We all love those things, but we've made it so easy for the government to know all of those things and so difficult for the merchants to know those things that this is a paradigm that many are trying to change. With respect to the study, what I think is fascinating is that we don't want merchants to have the sensitive information. Had Target never had your sensitive information, there would have never been a breach. Had the POS not had malware, entering in or swiping would have never been obtained. So comments that Russ makes about tokenization, I think, are exactly where we need to be heading. It's certainly where companies like PayPal and other mobile payments companies are heading. But the notion that we don't want merchants to have information about us is a bit alarmist and off-putting, because I want amazing services. I want them to be faster. I don't want to wait in lines. I want them to know what I want so that they can offer it to me at the best price. Half the time, I don't even know what's available in the store, and I'm not going to spend the time going through the racks. So I want those services. I believe many other people also want those services. The piece that we're learning is, how do we do this exchange with trust? Right? Does the merchant have all of this information before I've said it's okay, or do they have this information after I've said it's okay and they're my favorite? I would much prefer that I never have to hand my credit card to a waiter again. They go behind the corner. I have to trust them. I don't even know their name. Well, they have a name tag. It says Bob, but it might not even be Bob. He goes behind the counter. He does whatever with my credit card. and then he hands it back to me. Okay, I've just trusted a stranger with my most prized possession, my Amex card. Are you kidding me? Sorry.
Your what?
Sorry. Sorry. I've lost a friend.
Don't tell David either.
I know, that's true. I've lost a CEO as a friend. So, pulling this together, on the ID piece and synthetic ID fraud, I think what we've come to is, you know, who bears the brunt of the damage? You know, I know personally through a former member of my team that ID theft takes a lot of time out of your day. I know that you could, you know, the merchant or the bank, it takes a lot of risk and loss, you know, out of the bottom line, right? And so on those issues, to me the question is, how do we connect, how do we know sooner? So I work closely with information security, and we're always saying we will never be able to build the highest wall. We will build a high wall, but we also have to know when someone comes over the wall, and we have to know quickly. And when we know quickly, we can act quickly, we can mitigate. And so fortunately, the company has a great track record on information security. However, you have to focus on what happens when it happens. Providing the notice and the opportunity to do something quickly about it is the key pieces. And I think what we've seen over the last even 6 months is some fumbling where there has been a large event and they haven't been able to either detect it quickly or they've thought they've detected it, raised their hand and said, we've stopped it, and then unfortunately the bad actors posted on their site that, no, we're still in here. And so that internal piece is equally important. And so anything that says, you know, breach then strict liability or breach then must do the following binds the hands of entities to be able to move quickly once it's happened to mitigate further loss. I think the common theme both in both questions is the FCRA. In the one instance, is a credit report impacted with synthetic ID fraud? In the Hufnagel study, how can merchants receive information? What information do they receive? And I think an incredibly important point is companies need the information to be able to identify who someone is, and the difference between identifying who someone is to say, is this even someone that we know to be this individual, versus a decision, is this an individual, now that we know who it is, that we wish to provide services or credit? Those are two distinct questions. And I think that there is at times a blurring of using or understanding, am I using this information to know who someone is? And this is where when we think of, you know, something that is unique to you, something that is you, something that is known by you, the different layers of security, this is where we're seeing tremendous growth. I mean, imagine if the target POS had the third level or the third layer. Unfortunately, it wouldn't have mattered because there was a malware problem, right? And they would have now obtained potentially the third layer. And again, that's where Russ's point on tokenization does come in. I threw you that bone since I said the other word a minute ago. But I'm going to stop there. I think the common thread is FCRA, which I know you attempted to explain quite crisply. I was told by a law professor, if anyone has told you they're an expert in the FCRA, they're lying because there's no such thing.
So let's Laura, I think you reserved and a moment to respond, and then we'll go to the audience and see if you have questions. If not, I've got a couple more, but I'd rather hear from the audience.
Well, so just to respond to the comment, and I hope I'm not now, after the passage of time, misstating Tom's point about the sandwiches, which made me hungry, so I may have grown distracted. But, you know, I could not sleep at night if I thought that privacy laws and privacy standards caused consumers to get the wrong sandwich orders. I think the common theme across the laws that the FTC enforces, privacy is not unique. The privacy laws laws ensure that consumers' reasonable expectations are met. So if your reasonable expectation is that you have shared your information to obtain a sandwich, you would reasonably expect your information to be shared as needed to provide you the correct sandwich. So the you know, this reasonableness standard is a pillar of a lot of American law, a lot of law around the world, and I think it is largely an effective one.
Excellent. So do we have questions? Louise is in the back and has microphones, and you have the experts on the panel.
Hi. I have a question probably for Russell. My question is, what roles do payment companies like Visa, and how do you work with third-party device makers? The idea, the kind of issue that came to mind was the was Coin that was introduced this past fall, where you know there were some issues with the security and a lot of people weren't quite sure whether you could use that device. So, you know, do credit card companies or payment companies, are you willing to work with these third-party device makers, and what role can they play in increasing security and also preventing loss?
Sure, that's a great question. As far as the device makers, there's so many different device makers out there. It's not just, you know, do you have a Galaxy or do you have an iPhone, right? And there's so many different other things that are coming in that can be plugging into the top of them. PayPal has them as a picture of one, Square, all the rest of them. So you can't really work with everybody, although we certainly try to reach out and sort of do things. But what we have done is that we work with a lot of consortia and business and standard-setting companies that will put out things that you need to do. For example, there's a payment card industry data security standards, a PCI DSS, which are industry standards that come out and say, here's, you know, basically what you need to do from a security standpoint. And there's 12, 14 big ones, and there's pages and pages behind it. It's refreshed on an ongoing, every 2 to 3 year basis as technology unfolds. And it really lays out the kind of standards of what people are expecting when you're dealing with payments and data security. If you get into the chip issues, you know, for example, or in mobiles, we're trying to come out with standards, and there's this thing called EMVCo, which was originally founded by Europay, MasterCard, and Visa. Now it involves a lot of other groups that are as well getting into different standard settings. So it's, we're happy to work with and talk with and help develop things on a lot of different platforms, because you never know what different kinds of consumers are going to want. But you really have to look at those industry standards, hold yourself to them, map to them, and do the homework in order to really make it work.
So Russ's response and the invocation of industry standards reminds me of one of my favorite Adam Smith quotes. People of the same trade seldom meet together even for merriment and diversion, but the conversation ends in a conspiracy against the public or in some contrivance to raise prices. The members of PCI, just to be clear, are Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express. The members of EMVCo are, anyone want to guess? Oh, I forgot one, JCB. Members of EMVCo are, anybody want to guess? American Express, MasterCard, and Visa. Now, we can imagine a world in which those folks are getting together and creating standards for the commonweal, or we can remember what Adam Smith said 350 years ago.
Well, I never remembered it. I'd never heard most of that, but it's very amusing. I think that, and like many music things, has a ring of truth to it. But obviously, Tom, for the purposes of the time at hand, is going to a great simplification with regard to PCI-Co, because processors, merchants, all are involved in a lot of industry groups that are part of it as well. But yes, the large payment companies have to start working things and set it out. We've got resources. We certainly have the interest. And then you let the interested parties get together and figure out how it works.
Do we have another question? Yes.
My question is related to, thank you, Elena McKesson. My question is related to fingerprint ID and password. There are different expectations of privacy. Password is something I know, and fingerprints are something I have. So my question is, do you think fingerprint ID provides greater privacy and security protection? And second question is related to self-incrimination. For example, some courts argued that you cannot be forced to provide your password because there is the Fifth Amendment that protects you from self-incrimination, and I don't think the Fifth Amendment applies to biometrics data like your voice, your fingerprints, your hair. So do you think the fingerprint ID can create some constitutional implications on privacy protection?
Great, great questions. I'll take the first. I'm going to run like heck on the second one. On your first question with fingerprint and vis-a-vis password, it's not one or the other that makes it a more secure system. It's the fact that it's both. One is something you know. The other is something that you are. Combined with, particularly in the mobile payments space, something that you have, your phone. So your phone can have its own fingerprint, a combination of the types of apps that are on the phone, how it is commonly used, the type of device it is. Those types of things can all be combined to create a device fingerprint. So something you have, something you know, your password, and something that you are. Your fingerprint, your nose print, your whatever print you wanted to use.
Nose print?
The combination of those three. This is a good group. I like this group. So the combination of those three is what makes something more secure, because you have three layers, three things that you have to have, know, or be in order to obtain access to whatever the service or the device or whatever it might be. Specifically with fingerprint, I'm actually pleased. I haven't seen a lot of what could have been rather alarmist conversations about, well, is it my actual fingerprint? And does the actual fingerprint get, you know, stored as a photo? And is the actual fingerprint then shared with, as we all know, the government? Because I think that there's been good communication around the fact that it's not your actual fingerprint, that it's an algorithm taking pieces of your fingerprint and creating a hashed ID that is not the same as how other entities or other governmental organizations may do the same type of thing. And so as a result, it's not the same. And it doesn't have to be your thumb or this. You can do whatever combination is appropriate for you or that you feel comfortable with. So it's not one or the other. It's how a combination of all three will bring and is bringing much more secure device security.
Fingerprints are kind of tricky, though, and algorithms around fingerprints, because, you know, it is... if your PIN is hacked or you have multiple PINs, you need to change your PIN, it's easy to do. You do it. My PIN used to be 1234. Now it's going to be 4321. But it's hard to say, all right, my algorithm, if there's a hack of the algorithm of your fingerprint, whoever you've given it to, they have to change your algorithm rather than you change your fingerprint. So it's a static identifier. And so once again, you do get into the static versus dynamic identifiers, and which is better, which is why, you know, I'm selling a broken record, you go back to the kind of tokenization type of thing and the kind of chip thing where you know, the chip on the card or the device or the token that's associated with it, because it is dynamic, is not something that becomes such a big deal where you have to change an algorithm or change something else. And it's not as prone, obviously, to high-intensive hacking as even PIN blocks will become as the computing power available to criminals increases, you know, exponentially over the next few years. Is it something you should use? Sure. You need to have a lot of different tools. You need to have a lot of different layers. But there are a lot of concerns that you have to be keeping an eye on as you look ahead into technology.
And we have time for one more question in the back.
Hi. So going back to the misdirected sandwich, in real life, when a waiter wants to deliver a sandwich, he basically has to remember kind of where you're sitting and maybe your face briefly. And once he delivers the sandwich, he will erase you from his mental database. And he's not likely to ask you to make a quick copy of your address book either, right? So isn't it overly simplistic to say that, of course, we want to share with a merchant? I mean, there's all kinds of things that we don't want to share. And that's not the same as concealing. It's about controlling what you share with whom.
Yeah, yeah, and I think you know, our case law and our approach in this area has been very consistent with the point that you just made, that it's not just with whom you're sharing and for what purpose, but it's that the scope of what you share with them has to be consistent with that purpose. So, you know, a case like our case against the Path app, which was doing, you know, collecting address book information for all of its users, regardless of whether they wanted to find their friends listed in their address book, is an illustration of that point. So you can... You can do something contrary to a user's reasonable expectations by collecting too much data, even if you're the right person and acting in the course of the right action.
So I'm going to disagree. So only in the following sense, which is I think that the you've articulated a product experience that can be designed, but I don't think it should be mandated. So I think there's a difference, for example, between Twitter and Whisper. And I think that users are capable of deciding whether they want to use Snapchat on the one hand or Instagram on the other hand. So the particular sandwich experience that I had yesterday is not one in which the waiter would have been expected to remember my name or my face since I was standing in a herd of 50 people waiting for somebody to give me a banh mi five-spice chicken sandwich on Market Street. So, and frankly, I would really prefer that they would actually remember what sandwich that I want so that when I show up at the store that they can immediately place the order rather than having to stand in line for 30 minutes. But if you want to have a different experience and stand in that line every time, that's cool. I don't think the FTC or the state of California should mandate that experience for both of us.
And Scott, Russ will get you. You can have the last words.
Ooh.
If you want.
I think on the sandwich example, we're talking about sandwiches. This is fantastic.
This is great.
I take Tom's point as if there's a business model that says, you know what, we're going to share the information with the merchant always, as long as it's not deceptive, that should be permitted. And if there's a business model that says, we're going to let you choose, you can share the information with the merchant, it might mean you got to wait in the line, it might mean you don't have to wait in the line, but we're going to be transparent about that model, then you should be able to do that as well. There's my last word.
I don't take the last word when we're right before a coffee break. I've learned not to do that. But I was just talking to Laura. There's one enforcement that they did that I thought was just perfect and lays out some stuff.
So, I mean, I think the issue here is obviously transparency. So if you're in a sandwich shop, you perfectly understand that the waiter can see your face. But we brought a case against a flashlight app that was based on the idea the flashlight app was also collecting address book information and other information from users. And users would not, it's not transparent to users. And they wouldn't reasonably understand that to do what it is supposed to do, that the flashlight app is collecting this information.
Okay, excellent. And since we're talking about sandwiches, that reminds me I should thank Alston and Bird for sponsoring the breakfast. So thank you very, very much. And, we will...